Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You're listening to a talk as part of the Designing Longitudinal Research in Complex Multiprofessional Environments conference, organised by the Scottish Child Care and Protection Network. This talk was recorded on the 21st of April 2011. Marion Brandon, University of East Anglia. Social Work Perspective, a Longitudinal Study of Children at Risk of Significant Harm.
It's a privilege to be part of this group, and it does feel quite a treat. So I'm very pleased to be hanging on. And quite a tall order for me to finish off these 2 days. The expectations are quite high. But I think the organisers have been extraordinarily clever, really, because there's been a crossover from what we were hearing yesterday and today. And some of what I'm going to be talking about builds on that, but offers a different perspective and some similarities with what Emma was saying this morning. So what I'm talking about is not the great big cohort studies of thousands and thousands of children, but a much smaller study of children at the sharp end, really, of children living with significant harm. So it's looking in detail at the most vulnerable children. So the original study, it wasn't planned as a longitudinal study, but it seemed pretty clear that it would be a good idea to make it into a longitudinal study. So the funding came from the Department of Health, and it was part of a set of studies designed and funded to see whether the early wording of significant harm and the early implementation of the Children Act was working or not. And I know Jane was involved in summarising those studies, and this study was part of that. So that came out in 1999, and what that study offered was a detailed picture, a prospective study of a total cohort of children who were suffering significant harm in 4 areas. So although it's small, it is every child in those 4 areas who was deemed to be suffering significant harm. So that's quite important. But quite a broad range of ages. So some of these children had not yet been born and were deemed to have suffered significant harm while they were in utero, and others were as old as 18. So, from a research point of view, difficult having that great big age range. And these were all children who'd been newly identified as suffering or likely to suffer significant harm using the wording of the new legislation. So what we did at that time, we tracked the progress of these children over 1 year. So we did some measures and studies at the point of identification of harm, and then a year later. And we really were interested to see whether there had been effective protective and supportive action and their parents. But what was pretty clear at the 1 year stage was that some of the children had already been re-abused, as you might expect. But for up to a third of them, the situation was very much unresolved. So it seemed a very fertile ground to be coming back later to see how things had happened. And it was very clear to us that things were still in turmoil. So we decided, when we talked to families involved in the study, we asked them if they would be interested in us coming back again and got permission for that, which was handy. So 8 years on, we then had the difficulties, really, of working out how to track them down. And I think I was asked to really talk about the nuts and bolts of doing the study and how we got about it. So we had permission from 4 local authorities to start with to do the work, and they were all very engaged in this. And when we went back 7 to 8 years later, staffing had changed, and the people who engaged in the first place weren't necessarily engaged in the second place, and one of the authorities said no. And we couldn't believe they'd said no. And we said, this is for your benefit. And she said, no, what good has research ever done for us? You only want us for our black community. Which was very interesting. So, and we tried talking to various members, but it was a blanket no. So we couldn't follow up those children. We did have permission from the Department of Health to access files of children who'd been adopted. So it's interesting, they could give us permission on sensitive cases, but it was one senior manager who just would not shift. And we had social workers who we were still in touch with. We said, we can tell you about some children. We know about some of them. And it was very tempting. And I think, looking back, we might do it differently, but we decided to do it properly. But we did manage to, from the original 105, we did manage to catch up with 77, which isn't bad. And in the original 105, a half of them we only looked at files and had interviews with professionals, and the other half we had interviews with family members and children. And we had about that half and half in the 77. So 39 of them were from the original interview sample where families had agreed, and 38 were from the background sample where we were only looking at the written information. So it was a pretty good match with the original study. So we used quantitative and qualitative measures, but overall it was pretty much a qualitative study, really. So we were able to find 76 files from the children, and we constructed a file search which tried to give us some sort of uniformity, and it's very much the issue that Emma was talking about. These files all look very, very different, so we had a template for collecting comparable information where we could, which was also needed to get the best of what variable information there was on there. And we were then able to load it and code it to some extent, so we were able to do some counting and some descriptive statistics, and we put that onto SPSS. And the qualitative information came from interviews, and we were able to talk with 22 of the children. And we again had semi-structured schedules, which we adapted from Miriam Steele's work so that we could have an attachment perspective on what was going on with the children. But I think more importantly, we had play-based interviews that we'd use the first time round. So we wanted to make sure that the interviews with the children were enjoyable for them, that helped us get the best information from them. And so we wanted them to be able to talk about things like worries and concerns and who did they confide in. And did they have, who helped them? Who did they turn to for practical help? So that question was engaged to try and get information about men. Because often, you know, who helped with practical things is a question that can elicit a response about dads and other men. And in fact, we've been able to kind of carry that work on recently. And I've just done a study with a colleague for the Children's Commissioner in England, and we've adapted those same techniques, and it was really quite kind of nice to go with my box of tricks again to talk to more children. And so to try and talk about worries was quite hard, because if you talk to them and say, tell me what your worries are, they'll often say, well, they won't say anything. So we had kind of little cut-out bees that they could draw stripes on and talk about that. And for the study we've just done, we actually had little worry dolls in a little box that they could take out and put them in their hand, and which ones do you want to talk about. And visiting the children for the second time, it was very interesting, and I did some of the interviews first time and second time. And one child who I spoke to first time round had said that, you know, she'd said no to the worry question and just wanted to pass it by. And this time I could talk and say, well, you know, last time you said you didn't have any worries. But she said it was so bad then that I really couldn't say, which was, you know, you'd have that looking back perspective by kind of going back 8 years on. So we also had interviews with parents, birth mothers, one adoptive mother, and three birth fathers, and also carers, because some of the children were living with kin. So we scooped up two sets of grandparents, one aunt and two foster carers. So we had these very rich interviews where we were able to kind of get the story over time from the perspective of different family members. And then we did some standardized questionnaires. Now, we have the problem that was talked about. So when you've got really small cell sizes, you can't do much numerically with these standardized questionnaires. But it was useful to be able to triangulate all this information so that they gave us a bit of an inkling so we could see if what was coming from the questionnaires was in keeping with the other material we were getting from the files and from what the children said themselves. And we had an interesting discussion with Michael Rutter, because we use the Goodman SDQ had been developed by Rutter initially. And he was adamant that these scales must not be used for individual children. They must be used for big cohorts. But that's not being suggested. I mean, it's being suggested that they can be used for individual children in the English assessment framework materials. So we were kind of mindful of that and cautious about how we use them. But I think, you know, that is worth bearing in mind, that if you've got tiny numbers, they're not really telling you about individual children. They're telling you about communities of children. So we nevertheless had these sets of standardized questionnaires, which, and I think from the study, we've got a sense that you could have these very vulnerable children as a subset of much bigger groups. So you can see the extent to which things about them are fit in and nest alongside bigger populations or not. So what were some of the struggles and what were some of the kind of limitations of what we had to do? So as I said before, only 3 out of 4 of the original authorities agreed to participate. But in fact, it wasn't too bad because they did only amount to 13% of the original cases. But it did change the profile of the cases, in particular the ethnicity profile. So that was a limitation in our 77 cases. We only had files from social services. So the information we had about other agencies was what happened to be there in the social services files. And I have to say, it wasn't great information, and we had much better information from the children and the families who talked about help from different agencies. So we had one mum who said that the school had been great, and because of her relationship with the head teacher, the child had been kept in school, and the head teacher said, you know, his behaviour is pretty bad, and if it wasn't you and your family, we would have had to exclude him. So none of that was really in the file. So that kind of, I think, looking back now, I think I would put more weight by those interviews and the qualitative information and the information that's come from the children and the families, because it was very rich, really. And I think at the time we were thinking that our best source of information was the files. And I'm not sure it was, to be honest. But when you've got that match-up of information from children, from parents, the second time we didn't talk to workers, we did the first time, then it does help you get a much rounder picture and a richer picture of what's going on. The other issue is that we had access via gatekeepers, and I know we talked about that yesterday. Paul was talking about that yesterday. And we were obliged to be led by the gatekeepers, so we only got access to the files through the gatekeepers. And I think if we were doing it again, it's better if you don't have to own. If the families have said yes, then why couldn't we go back to the social workers that we were still in touch with who knew the children? So we couldn't get the files, but we could have got them. And one of the problems about going via gatekeepers is that, come back to that. We also found it was easier to track cases that had been known for a long time. So the records were there. What we weren't able to check were children without problems. So we had not much less information on successes. So we had to, in a sense, interpret success as a closed case. But when we went back and visited some of the children whose cases had been closed, it was clear that they had quite significant problems, but not enough to warrant services from children's social care. So that was interesting. So you're likely to get severity if you're following only tracking cases that are known at the time. And the good and better outcome cases were missed, and I think we missed a competition standardised skater, which is a bit sad. So this was a child who had experienced significant harm, who the social worker had known him for a long time, and it would have been lovely to have had that story about resilience and success, but only anecdotally. So, as I said, files aren't compiled in a standardised way. They're variable, sometimes information's limited, and sometimes there was overwhelming quantity of information that we had to sift through and make sense of, as you'll have come across yourself, Emma. And we did rate and rank the files, about a third of them were good and told the story of the child and gave us a good sense of what had happened and how. About a half were satisfactory, but 1 in 5 were seriously deficient. And the sorts of deficiencies were children's own views were missing in 1/4 of the files. And it was interesting that information about parents dwindles over time, and information about fathers was sparse pretty much from the beginning. So although that wasn't very helpful in terms of the information it told us, it's quite useful to know that so that we can be starting to kind of get messages about the need to not lose this information over time. So, as I said, I think we maybe expected too much from files. So from the files, we could get a sense of the length and the pattern of involvement, which was interesting, and how much continuity there'd been from social work services. We also got a good sense of the child's protection status and legal status over time, and child's story to some extent. And from the interviews, we did get rich information about the nature and intensity of involvement, as I said, about from a range of practitioners as well as just social workers. So I don't want to be talking about the findings, but this kind of picture of what happened to the children, I can't tell you how long it took to construct this. It looks fairly straightforward, but about a week I spent wrestling with trying to kind of get this, just a sense of what happened to the children. So they came at the, you know, where the 77 were at the top, four of them were in placements, 70 were at home and 3 were removed at birth. Some went through the child protection system here. Some, 20 of them went through family support services. So at that time, some areas had quite robust processes for planning and helping children in a multi-agency way without them needing to go through through child protection. Now, they didn't all necessarily stay at home, so it was a bit of a mix. So 47 changed carers, 30 stayed with the same carers. And then they had different patterns of what happened to them. And in terms of the outcomes, we were able to kind of talk about the outcomes from these different groups. And I think one of the interesting findings that's come out of this study is that those who had been removed from home but then went back home didn't fare very well. And I'll come back to talk about that. And that's been matched by Elaine Farmer's study of children returning home where there's been neglect. So just in terms of the kind of re-abuse rates, 57% of the children had been abused again at some point over the 8 years. So that could be at any time between the first follow-up time and the last follow-up time. But this group was particularly interesting. There were 6 children who were abused at all 3 time points when we collected them. And that was quite shocking. And there was one case of a child we were able to track. And it was on and off the register at the time. It wasn't continuously on the register, but pretty much continuously. And the initial category was neglect. Then it was physical injury. Then it was emotional abuse. Then it was sexual abuse. So without knowing anything about, you know, just what that tells you about that child who never left home, always remained at home. And she wasn't able to engage in any of the interviews. I think she had a learning disability. Whether the learning disability was innate or whether it was because of the neglectful care she'd had from the beginning. And it brought up an issue that I think you talked about, Emma, about what we do when we see bad practice. And I felt obliged to go to the agency and say, you know, this child has lived with significant harm for 8 years. What are you doing about it? And they said, oh, well, we're planning for the mum to go into rehab and she'll come into care then. So I had to leave it at that point, but it wasn't satisfactory. So, right, so a little bit about outcomes for the children, then we need to move on so we can have our discussions. So we used researcher ratings. We had a group of 3 researchers and we were able to kind of compare across using the range of aspects of well-being. So we used the scales, we used the qualitative information, we sort of matched up everything we had to try and get a sense of the outcome for the children. And we determined that 72% had been protected, but that was protected in a very qualified way to some extent. So it was pretty kind of low level. For 28% of the children, so more than a quarter, there were still quite serious concerns about their well-being and protection. So overall, the development, the mental health one was interesting. So 60% of the children had long-standing conduct problems. And that was actually a higher rate than children in care. So given that sort of quite a lot of these children were at home, their well-being was not overall particularly good. Lots of interesting issues about stability and loss. So lots of the children had numerous moves between carers, and a high proportion had experienced the death of a parent through substance misuse or accidents. And that was comparable with the Swedish study. So lots of children lived with cumulative losses, and the abuse rates I've talked about were high. So that was our kind of summary of the outcomes for the children at the end. So only 9 of the children, 12%, did we think had a pretty good well-being. And quarter of them were doing okay, but some concerns. And this is the slightly tricky bit, that the closed cases we had to say, because they didn't come back to social services, we have to presume they were okay enough. So we included those in the good enough well-being. And so it's pretty much these were okay and these were not at all okay. So still concerns, and the 3 children had, there was no clear improvement since time 1. And for 19 of them, there were still serious concerns about their well-being or it had deteriorated. So I guess we sort of used grounded theory then. I hadn't really consciously thought I was using grounded theory, but I looked at those 9 children and I thought, well, what is it about those 9 children that we think makes us think that they're doing pretty well? And I looked at Fonagy's book about evaluation of child mental health treatments, and he came up with these developmental domains, and all of those 9 children matched up with these. So that seemed a pretty good way of kind of double-checking that they were doing okay at that time. So none of these 9 children had any symptoms of mental ill health. And they'd all adapted very well to their psychosocial environment. They'd had lots of moves but had been settled for a while. They were doing okay at school, had friends, were able to make relationships, were healthy. So across, you know, and were making transitions from primary school to secondary school or from, you know, nursery into school. And it appeared that they had strong cognitive and emotional capacity. So the transactional aspects of their development were looking good, as I'd said. So their development was adapting to the changes that were required within their environment. So that seemed quite a good way of checking that those 9 children at that time seemed to be doing well. So just to sum up, so we have time for some discussions, what do we know about change over time over 8 years and looking at this study of maltreatment? So there are problems of keeping a longitudinal study going, and we heard about those yesterday. So we did branding. We sent back, we tried to keep our original logos, and the children did remember, and the parents remembered from, you know, over 8 years from, they couldn't quite remember, but it just triggered something, so that was worth doing. Our funding, we only had funding to do it once, unlike these very well-funded big cohort studies. We had a little tiny bit of money from the NSPCC, so we knew we probably wouldn't be able to do it again. So it's a great pity, because this would be a great group of people to follow up again. As I've said, the small sample size and the large age range poses problems for the methodology and use of scales, measures and comparability, so you have to just compare them with themselves, really. But having a whole cohort, which is what we had, so we had all the maltreatment cases from all of the study sites, does provide rigour and does mean that it is quite an important study, really. So there is, as I said, the problem of measuring and tracking success. If success is a closed case, it's a bit feeble as a measure. The complexity of the children's stories and experiences did seem to be captured by a mix of methods, so we did have a good sense of their stories, which I think we could represent quite well. But, and this has been a kind of recurring theme really, we can't know whether the success was linked to the intervention. What the children were able to tell us and what the file was able to tell us was whether or not there was continuity of worker, whether the relationship had been good with workers, and one file said that they felt that they'd failed a family by never giving them a black worker, and the family, a black family, said that they had really felt they'd got on very well with a worker who was very sympathetic and sensitive and understood. So, you know, there were interesting contradictions there. The new learning is that the mental health was worse for children living at home with significant harm than in care. So for once we've got a good news story about good quality care. Including kinship care, because some of these children were with kin, and that return home can be a riskier outcome. So I think we have a challenge getting routine data to tell us a coherent story. It is possible, but I think it's useful if we can do deep dives into cohorts of very vulnerable children to give us a better story and a richer story. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
This recording is copyright of Iris 2011. It may be reused in the terms of Creative Commons licenses, attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 2.5, UK Scotland license. Go to www.iris.org.uk for more information.